Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest is Jennifer Sims, who is a professorial lecturer at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. She's also a freelance writer and a private consultant in Washington. Dr. Sims has served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Intelligence Coordination and as the State Department's first coordinator of intelligence resources and planning. Before coming to state, Dr. Sims served as Senator John Danford's defense and foreign policy advisor and his designee to the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. Jennifer, welcome to Berkeley.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born in Washington, D.C. And shortly after that, my family moved to Greenwich, Connecticut, where I was raised until my college years.
And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your character?
My parents had a tremendous impact on my character. They have been married now for 60 years, and they raised four children. And I think the best way to capsulize the impact of my parents on my way of looking at the world and also the specific question of character. My mother, who raised all four of us, went back to work when I was in college, and she became eventually the first woman mayor of Greenwich, Connecticut. In Greenwich, that's called the position of first selectman, and the first Democrat in 75 years to be elected. And she gained that post. I'm convinced she was elected because of her ability to listen, her balanced viewpoint, non-dogmatic viewpoint, and open-mindedness. But the most important image I have of her was election night, a huge upset. And the Democratic Party had all convened en masse in Democratic headquarters. And they came to my mother and said, "It's time to march down Main Street and take City Hall." And my mother, who was riding high at that moment, and there were balloons and applause, my mother said, "No, that would not be the gracious thing to do." And she turned to me and she said, because I was standing right next to her, and she said, "Remember this, Jennifer, always with grace." Mm-hmm. And that was very profound. It had a huge impact on me. And I, as I remembered that humility and grace, I tried to remember that during my time in government when I was given more and more responsibility. And it's a hard thing to do, because to be effective in Washington, you must be forceful at times. You have to stand your ground at times. And I'd like to think that at least 99% of the time I was able to remember my mother's words.
And what about your father?
My father, I'm glad you asked about that, because he has had a long and productive career in higher education. He was vice president of the College Entrance Examination Board, and he also worked for a while for the State Department, and was involved in testifying during the McCarthy period, and the experience so rattled him and upset him that he moved his family up to New York, the New York area, and went into international education instead of pursuing a career in Washington, D.C. There were other reasons for that, but that had a profound impact on him. And he was the rock of Gibraltar for our family during a lot of ups and downs, including the loss of my sister at a very young age for her. And, you know, when my mother sailed high after his retirement, he had retired, and she hit her career peak, and he went from being a very high-flying professional himself to being, I don't like the term house husband, but he was supportive, he was cooking dinners, he was helping her in every way. The flexibility, the sense of who he was, the core inner strength. He took a lot of flack from the press for being sort of the man behind the powerful woman in certain circumstances, and his grace and his strength and flexibility, as well as his intelligence, was important.
So was there a lot of conversation around the dinner table about politics and world affairs?
Yes, there was. Both my parents engaged all of us children in dinner conversations about world events. And I remember from a very young age being impressed with the range of knowledge that both my parents had and expected us to have. Dinner was a set time every night. My father came home on the train from New York City at a set time. We were all expected to be at the dinner table. And I remember for many, many years being principally a listener because I was a dancer through my high school years and thinking I was going to be a professional dancer. And while I listened a lot, I didn't engage a lot, nor did I think that this was going to be my future. But as it turned out, I went to college, got radicalized while I was in college, ended up being very involved in the politics surrounding the Vietnam War, very interested and concerned about it, and went into government, left my dancing career and went into government as a result. And at that period of time, interestingly enough, my father, and I think this was unusual for most students at Oberlin, my father was more radical on the war than I was. Mm-hmm. He was very, very, at the time, I think, considered left wing. And I was sort of center left. So listening to my father's points of view and then trying to listen to other points of view, I recognized the passion with which my father approached international politics. And I have tried to retain some of that passion while also retaining the open-mindedness that had been, you know, a keystone of those dinner conversations that we had.
When you went into government, or you began this career in government, was the feeling that you would change things? I often run into this issue of how the 60s affected your generation, so I'll ask you.
One of the big effects of the 60s and 70s on me was a belief in the importance of our institutions. Actually, the 70s were a jolting experience for those of us who lived through them. I went off to college in Oberlin a year after Ohio's Kent State happened. And then I saw, essentially, democratic politics bring to an end a involvement overseas that the mass of public opinion was critical of. And I realized the importance of our institutions and the integrity of our institutions. Same for Watergate. Watergate had that impact on me as well. And so I came in actually with less of a sense of I'm going to change the way business is done, and much more with an awe of our institutions. I was sitting on the Senate floor during the vote to authorize the use of force against Saddam Hussein. And I will never, ever forget that feeling of honor and privilege to be there at that historic moment. That still is with me. After 10 years of government, the respect for the taxpayer and the important responsibility of being in an institutions accountable to the people. You know, in my last job, somebody, it used to be one of the mantras in our office, we were dealing with intelligence resources and planning, and I tried to convey to all the staff at all times, remember your bosses are the taxpayers. We must remember that first and foremost. I think that is the legacy of the Vietnam period, for me anyway.
What are the particular difficulties that democracies have with regard to foreign policy and intelligence?
That's a very, very good question. And I think since September 11th, we are grappling with this question front and center. And it's symbolized by the compromise struck on the U.S. Patriot Act that was passed by Congress.
And explain what the U.S. Patriot Act.
The U.S. Patriot Act was an act passed following Congress's approval of the use of force to find and terminate the terrorists that perpetrated 9/11. And it gave additional authorities, among other things, it gave additional authorities to the law enforcement and intelligence communities to do their business, including roving wiretaps for national security purposes for the FBI and the sharing of grand jury testimony to the intelligence community. And it allowed the intelligence community to take that information and integrate it into its analyses. And this was a departure from the Watergate, post-Watergate period, when Congress and the American people came to understand how far the law enforcement community, particularly the FBI, had gone in its efforts to investigate communist or alleged communist activity and anti-government activity in the civil rights movement. It had led to abuses of power. And the intelligence community had also been involved in some of that activity. And that led to the creation of oversight committees that would allow Congress to keep a watch on what the executive branch was doing in this area. I think the balance struck after that period, the Watergate period, and the exposure of the plumbers and the abuses during J. Edgar Hoover's period at the FBI. That balance was struck for a particular period in time. The U.S. Patriot Act is a completely new balance that is being struck. And it is in recognition of the fact that we're at war, that we are pursuing terrorists who are trying to use our very open and, if you will, liberal political system to perpetrate devastating attacks against us. And so there was a feeling that we needed to give more power and authority to the institutions that are responsible for protecting the American people. Whether that is the correct balance for the present time remains to be seen. We need to watch very carefully and be very vigilant to make sure that those additional powers are not abused. It does not mean that that balance will be correct for 10, 15, 20 years from now. And this goes back to my comment on our institutions. Mm-hmm. One of the strengths of our institutions is its flexibility. And while we gave a lot of powers to the FBI and the CIA post-World War II, and the rest of the intelligence community post-World War II, and we're giving them additional powers now, it's important for Americans to be educated about what powers they've given away to these institutions and be ready to take them back if they need to be.
The other problem, in addition to preserving, finding the new balance and preserving the democratic institutions, is responding to new challenges. And one gets the sense that with the end of the Cold War in 89, the fall of the Berlin Wall, that the world of intelligence foundered a little because of a lack of mission. Is that a correct interpretation?
I think part of that is a correct interpretation. This was a real problem, and it continues to be a problem of ours. The intelligence community during the Cold War had a script. It knew exactly who the enemy was, and it knew it was going to have plenty of resources to collect against that enemy, and against the threat, the primary threat of a major nuclear attack against this country. It didn't need to be told that over and over again. Those requirements did not change substantially over a number of decades. This actually led to a problem in the intelligence community. There became a sense in which the intelligence community thought of itself as a service industry. And policymakers, especially in the national security bureaucracies, thought of the intelligence community as service people. And a gap emerged. In a sense, intelligence was sort of thrown over the threshold for policymakers who picked it up, read it. If they thought it was good and important, they kept it. If they didn't, they tossed it back. But there was not a lot of dynamic and flexible interaction between them. Mm-hmm. That's a very general statement. But in terms of a model to think about how intelligence supported the national security establishment prior to the collapse of the Soviet Union, it is a useful model. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, suddenly we had our major adversary gone. And the question was, what do we need intelligence for? And there were some senators on the Hill, and Jack Danforth, my boss, and Senator Glenn were two of them, also Senator Warner, who said, but this is a period of uncertainty. And during periods of uncertainty, that's precisely when you need your intelligence most. Mm. But there was a huge wave or momentum to cut back, to get the rewards of having won the Cold War, to get some of the resources back for other purposes, a very understandable desire. And so anything in the intelligence community labeled Soviet was axed. These cuts had to happen quickly. The taxpayers wanted it. It was expected. It was sort of the reward for having won the Cold War. As a result, we lost a number of intelligence programs that were highly applicable to the post-Cold War period. I wouldn't want to specify exactly what those programs were, but some of them it led to gaps in the 90s in intelligence collection. And unfortunately, I think it also affected our ability to do human intelligence, which people are talking about a lot now, post 9/11. We took some serious hits in our ability to bring into the CIA, to train, and to maintain a human intelligence cadre overseas. The other thing, though, that happened was we rapidly got into another war. We got into the Persian Gulf War. And the military never forgot the importance of intelligence support to military operations. To win a war, a modern war, you need very good, very flexible intelligence. And so when we were victorious after the Gulf War, we did a lessons learned on, you know, sort of what we needed to build back into the intelligence community that we had lost in our rapid cutting of previous years, and what new things were needed. And of course, the demands for intelligence support to precision guided weapons was one. And that required a lot of new technology. But the other thing that was recognized was that we needed to do better at getting those big national collectors, the imagery satellites, and our signals intelligence capability to support tactical commanders on the ground. And there were some major disconnects in that support. The focus on support to military operations after the Gulf War meant and this is a very long answer to your question, I know, but it did mean that the intelligence community became skewed, in my view. Mm-hmm. It became significantly skewed, both resource-wise and mission-wise, towards support to military commanders in the field. And what we lost in that process was a strong capability in the area of strategic warning and, in effect, tactical warning of the kind that led to or was involved in my view, some of the failures prior to September 11th.
Intelligence, the work of government, the use of intelligence in government is not a scientific inquiry. The word intelligence is bandied around and it makes the listener or the reader think that in fact there's a formula there. There's one piece of information that would reveal the world and to us and how we should act. Help us understand that a little. When we're bandying this word around, what should we understand intelligence to mean?
The definition of intelligence that I use is the collection, analysis, and dissemination of information tailored to the needs of national security decision makers. The word tailored to the needs of is, those words are very, very important because intelligence is not just a stack of newspapers on somebody's desk. It's the provision of information specific to the decisions that are being taken by the government to secure the nation. But this also means that a stack of newspapers can be turned into intelligence. Intelligence doesn't have to be just about secrets. It's interesting because one of the greatest coups in the history of intelligence for the U.S. was the Battle of Midway during World War II. We had broken the Japanese code, but naval codes, but the Japanese didn't know that we had broken those codes. In fact, the fact that we not only broke those codes, but manipulated what the Japanese understood we were doing during Midway as a result of knowing what they were, what their codes were, all of that was revealed in the Chicago Tribune. The fact that we had broken the Japanese code, now that it was out in the open literature, could have seriously undermined our naval strategy after Midway.
So it appeared in the paper at the time?
Yes. Yeah. The Chicago Tribune published the fact that we had broken the Japanese code, which was why we had such a terrific coup at Midway. Mm-hmm. Now, if the Japanese, now from our perspective, that was a horrific leak, and everybody was terribly worried about it at the time. If the Japanese had been reading open source information, if they thought of newspapers as intelligence or potential intelligence, they might have learned that we had broken their code, but they weren't reading the Chicago Tribune, so they didn't know. The point of this is that leaks are important, of course, but from the other side, leaks are open source information that are that's available to you. Therefore, an intelligence community that ignores open source information is putting itself in peril and putting the government it serves in peril. So intelligence in terms of secrets, yes, that's important. Secrets are important to intelligence. But in the world of the internet and this information revolution that is underway, some of the most important information we need from a national security perspective may be open source information buried in just rafts and rafts of material. And therefore, information processing, open source information processing, is a critically important aspect of modern intelligence service.
And so what is it, a coordinator, which is the role that you held in the State Department, what is it you need to grapple with this avalanche of information? Is it a theory about the world that's helpful in this regard, you know, a sense of who our adversaries are? Is it a sense of the political priorities of the president, which is also suggested in what you said?
Well, the Clinton administration grappled with this, and in fact, the National Security Council decided to set up a set of requirements for the intelligence community, and a set of tiers of the most important intelligence requirements for the national security policy community, starting at the highest tier going down to the lowest tier, and provided that to the intelligence community and told the intelligence community that these requirements at the highest level would be revised on occasion. This was quite different than the way we did requirements during the Cold War, which was a very bureaucratic process and very kind of static. The idea here was it would come from the White House down, and that it would be if not an annual thing, then rather regularly revised. Unfortunately, there was so much fighting over intelligence requirements because everybody understood that they were going to get intelligence resources applied to their particular problem depending on how forcefully they talked about the priority of their particular problem, whether it was worldwide famine or the environment or weapons proliferation or counterterrorism. Everybody was competing. All the policymakers were competing now for intelligence resources and wanted to fight to get into the highest tiers. After all those fights were done, nobody wanted to reopen the question. So those tiers stayed pretty static right through the Clinton administration. Now, of course, apart from the White House requirements to the intelligence community, there's the day-to-day interaction with the intelligence community that, as a practical matter, is much more important. As policy evolves and the day-to-day agenda of the national security community in Washington evolves, the interaction at the mid-level between intelligence community analysts and policymakers makes it clear what's most important sort of on a day-in, day-out basis, and a dialogue takes place. Unfortunately, one of the problems with the modern intelligence structure, from my perspective, is that together with the cutbacks in human intelligence and sort of the lack of perceived great threat after the collapse of the Soviet Union led to a real curtailment of our ability to do opportunistic intelligence overseas. It became defensive intelligence. We sort of tied the hands of our human intelligence collectors and told them, you can only go get the information that we've told you the policymakers require. If you sniff something out or come up with a good idea or a good source that might tell you something new, something over the horizon that policymakers haven't thought of yet, you don't have any resources to pursue it. this is a terrible problem. An intelligence community can't solely work on the basis of articulated requirements from policymakers. They must also, an intelligence community must also be able to feel what's coming and provide warning about what policymakers don't know will be on their agenda in the next few days or the next months or years. And I think we became a little bit weak and hesitant and tentative, particularly in the human intelligence area, and not particularly because of a fault of the CIA, but more because of the kind of mindset we were in post-Cold War.
So does that say to us that one of the weaknesses of a democracy is that we lack the ways to shake the system up a little, and we have to wait until event occurs that makes the kind of need you just described necessary because of the event?
That's very well put. I think that people are talking now about whether the intelligence community failed or not prior to 9/11. I want to make it very clear from my perspective, we had a failure of intelligence, as significant a failure of intelligence as we had at Pearl Harbor. But that doesn't necessarily mean the intelligence community is either principally at fault or necessarily at fault at all. A lot has to be put on the policymaker's side and actually on the democratic system, because it's very hard to mobilize resources and move resources towards a threat that you haven't convinced the American people is really a threat to them. Congress was funding intelligence support to military operations post-Gulf War because they understood Saddam Hussein was a problem and they understood the kind of threat that Iraq posed. It is true that the intelligence community said over and over again, Osama bin Laden is a tremendous threat. Terrorism is a tremendous threat. We'd been hearing that from the intelligence community for quite a while. Actually moving resources against that and giving the human intelligence collectors the authorities and essentially the abilities to go out and pursue that threat and try and go after it, that was another story. So I think that there's plenty of blame to spread around for the failure of 9/11, which I do believe was a failure.
One gets a sense that in the work of intelligence, information is politicized from the get-go. Is that a correct interpretation? In other words, that part of the struggle that people in the intelligence community have to wage on a daily basis is making the information as scientifically sound as possible. But as soon as you have it, it's there to be politicized by others.
Well, politicization has been a very contentious issue in the intelligence community. As you may recall, during the nomination hearings for former Director of Central Intelligence Robert Gates, the issue of whether or not he politicized intelligence was front and center and shaped the whole debate and eventually the vote on his nomination.
He had been deputy director of the CIA, and at the height of the Cold War, or the last phases under the Reagan administration, he had been accused of providing information in such a way as to favor his political bosses. Yeah.
Well, he also had been an analyst within the CIA. Mm-hmm. He knew very well the tradecraft of intelligence analysis, but he also had very strong political views. I think the whole debate over politicization is a little bit of a red herring, if you will. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons we debate it is that there has been a long tradition in American intelligence, national level intelligence, since the 1950s, when the father of American intelligence tradecraft, analytic tradecraft, by the name of Sherman Kent, outlined how intelligence analysts should behave vis-a-vis the policymakers they support. And one of his principles was that an intelligence analyst must stay absolutely objective with respect to the facts. It reflects, if you will, an American cultural, intellectual tradition of scientific rationalism. Just stick to the facts. and a great regard for those facts, and that if you stuck to the facts, you would know the truth. That required maintaining distance from the angst that policymakers were going through with respect to the choices that they needed to make. You took the intelligence to them, you gave it to them, but you didn't advise them about what to do with it. I think that whole approach is being re-looked at in some important ways. There's no question but that everybody believes you shouldn't play around with the facts. You shouldn't distort them or skew them for policy purposes. But analysts do need to get right in the thick, in my view, of policy discussions to help leaven them, enlighten them with the best information available from open sources as well as from classified sources to help people make the choices they need to make. There's a great quote from Schwarzkopf. The military understand this very well. They want their intelligence people right with them to help them choose which bridge to go over. They don't want to just be informed about what bridges are out and which bridges are still up. They want actual input into their next decision. Schwarzkopf had a great quote after the Persian Gulf War. He said, you know, he was criticizing the national intelligence collectors. And he said, you know, the problem is I'd get these guys telling me that the bridge was 50% destroyed or 40% destroyed. He said, what does that mean to me? I want to know whether I can go over the bridge or not. I'm not interested in the percentage of destruction. I'm interested in the utility of the bridge. Will it hold up a tank? And if analysts don't understand what's inside the policymakers' heads, what is shaping the choices there, they will miss providing the critical information the policymakers needs to make those choices.
What if the politicians want to stay away from issues? Because one of the criticisms of President Clinton and his presidency was that really he was a domestic president. He wanted to get the American economy back up to speed and so on. How do you address or answer that question, that criticism?
Well, I think that if somebody were to argue that the Clinton administration was not focused on foreign policy, it would be shocking. Mm-hmm. You had a Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, who traveled around the world more than any other Secretary of State before her. Really an extraordinary commitment to our overseas interests. And of course, the Clinton administration dealt with North Korea, dealt with Somalia, dealt with Bosnia, had a tremendous effort in the area of arms control, non-proliferation. I could go on. I think that the Clinton administration spent a lot of time on foreign policy, and many of the critiques are, in fact, that it spent too much time on foreign policy and that it made some strategic errors or tactical areas in that domain, which I don't really want to go into at this point. But that the administration was committed to foreign policy, I think, is really unquestioned or should be unquestionable. It's also true that he was very committed to domestic policy. And in fact, we had very good economic growth during that period, as everyone knows. But you do put your finger on one thing that I think was probably among the most, from my perspective, unfortunate things that happened in the Clinton administration with respect to commitment to overseas efforts. I don't think that the Department of State is anywhere near funded the way it needs to be in order to execute the very ambitious agenda of the Clinton administration and now the Bush administration. It is absolutely appalling to me, mm-hmm. the hollow diplomatic infrastructure we have. The war we are fighting is a war unlike any before it. It is a diplomatic law enforcement and military engagement. And the only aspect of it that really seems to be very well funded is the defense and defense-related intelligence aspects of it. Mm. The resources for the State Department are minimal. I was very disappointed in the recent budget submitted by President Bush in that regard. And I also believe the Clinton administration, for all its commitment to our diplomatic endeavors, terribly underfunded the Department of State.
And this was partly in response to Congress, correct? I mean, Jesse Helms is chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee?
Yes. People have talked a lot about the difficulty that Helms presented for funding the State Department. But I think in looking hard at Congress, one really overlooks the first issue, which is what is the budget that the President submits to Congress in the first place? Mm-hmm. And the broker of that is the Office of Management and Budget. From my perspective, the State Department never got a full and integrated hearing in OMB. By integrated, I mean the State Department is supports the worldwide infrastructure for U.S. government agencies deployed overseas, and we have more and more agencies. The FBI is now present in many, many countries. When I left in last year, when I left the State Department, there were, I think, somewhere between 150 and 200 FBI agents overseas. A very large growth in law enforcement presence, but also the Agriculture Department, the defense attachés. Many, many agencies are represented in our embassies overseas. And yet, the information infrastructure for those embassies, the buildings, the security of those buildings were really seriously underfunded. And it wasn't until the embassies were bombed in Africa that the security funding got pumped up for the State Department. But you can't just fund security. You have to fund more than that. You have to fund the purchase of good buildings in the first place for embassies. You have to fund communications. It's startling but true that only 20 of our something like 280 posts overseas, only 20 of them had classified web-based connectivity to State Department headquarters. Just when Secretary Powell came into office, it's really a very sad state of affairs.
One of the important elements in all of this seems to be the very process that was part of your title at the State Department, coordination. Can you give us a sense of the conundrum there, where the government sometimes doesn't know what the left hand is doing, or the right hand doesn't know what the left hand is doing, where one unit of the government attempts to gather information, gathers it, but then doesn't share it with another unit of the government? Give us a handle on that problem, well, which seems to be rather enormous in our government.
Well, I think there are two aspects of that problem, or at least two aspects of the problem. One aspect is technological and has to do with legacy systems, information systems that exist in each agency. Most American people would be astonished to hear that our open source information systems in our various agencies can't speak to one another. Mm-hmm. That's even at the unclassified level. That's because those systems were designed and funded at different times and separately so that they aren't necessarily compatible.
Then when you look at the computer
networks and sharing of databases.
Yeah.
Now, to the extent that the difficulties in compatibility are identifiable and you want to then begin to share information between the agencies, and you figure out what you need to do technologically, you have to get the resources for it, of course. But that's a doable thing, at least ideally. But then you end up with issues of security. Mm-hmm. And agencies are concerned that if they aren't in charge of the security protocols for another for a system that is connecting up with its agency's system, that then they will have a problem with anything from viruses to insider security problems. And there was much talk about how some of the biggest threats to the integrity of U.S. government information systems is not from the outsider coming inside our firewalls, but from the insider, trusted insider, exploiting problems, security in the system itself. So in any case, there is a set of technological issues involved here, but there are also the issues of I'd call it political cultural issues in intelligence sharing in the U.S. government. And some of this has to do, it's not because U.S. government employees are bad people, but they come with a definite sense of mission. For example, let me just give you a hypothetical. I mentioned that our law enforcement community is spread worldwide now. That reflects an effort on the part of the former director of the FBI, Louis Freeh, to, in the wake of the collapse of the Soviet Union, export our knowledge of the rule of law and how to build accountable law enforcement entities overseas in new governments. And he traveled around the world to do this. Hmm. And we developed a training center overseas to do it, and we developed new liaison with law enforcement officers overseas. The idea here was to go after transnational threats that were of mutual concern. International organized crime, international terrorism, that kind of thing. But also, the FBI helped these new governments weed out corruption and institute integrity and accountability in their own governments. At the same time, the State Department is overseas, hoping that the intelligence services will develop sources and information that helps keep certain governments in power. So you have the law enforcement community recruiting sources and dealing with liaison with host governments, and you have the intelligence community developing sources, not necessarily to preserve a given government in power. And the sources could overlap. The sources could be working at cross purposes with one another. And so one of the big issues during the Clinton administration was how to make sure that law enforcement and intelligence work together, sharing enough information, but without threatening, certainly in the national security area, sources and methods for example, the CIA. This is a very tough problem. The law enforcement culture is that the most important thing is the rule of law, not politics. From the State Department and the intelligence community's point of view, the rule of law is extremely important in terms of their own operations and the way the U.S. system works. But overseas, the most important thing is security. And sometimes security, the security interests of our country, trump the law enforcement interests of the country in which they're operating. After all, the CIA breaks these laws all the time. So to have the FBI there helping a host government enforce the rule of law and the CIA there trying to break those laws to serve the national security purposes of the U.S. government puts them, on the face of it, at cross purposes. Now, you can reconcile those things, but information sharing becomes more problematic when the missions, the drive, drives are so very different. We can do this. We have been doing it. We are doing it. We're getting better at it. But sometimes it's the right hand not knowing what the left hand is doing because there's been a mistake or there's been a technological problem. And sometimes it's deliberate. And deciding where that line is a very important problem for the national security community.
Going back to your background and what you told us about your growing up experiences and then your experiences of the 60s, I'm curious how you think through these conflicts, the one you just described. On the one hand, a respect for our domestic institutions, our civil liberties, and so on. And on the other hand, an understanding and a respect for our national security interests. Share with us a little about how your mind and emotions work in that process, because you seem to be on the horns of a dilemma, and you have both an understanding and sympathy of both sides.
I teach a course now at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies on the art and practice of intelligence. And I told my students the most important thing when you're dealing in the world of intelligence is integrity. Because while there is accountability built into the world of intelligence in the U.S. government, it isn't the kind of accountability you have in the very open aspects of public policy. A lot depends on a very deep and well-anchored sense of integrity and respect for the institutions and the taxpayers' interests And then you have to make the call. We go to war on occasion because the American people feel threatened. And the World Trade Center disaster is an example of the terrible pain that can be inflicted on this country if we don't do national security well. National security can be extraordinarily important and makes you, on occasion, have to sit back. You know, I wasn't sure I could ever be comfortable with covert action before I got involved in the intelligence business. One of my jobs as coordinator of intelligence for the State Department was to be very involved in decisions related to covert action. And I constantly had to try to make the very best decision I could based on the fact that if I made a mistake, we could end up with a disaster hitting this country. If I tied the hands of the community too much, and on the other hand, remembering my father's experience during the McCarthy era and how, and the Vietnam and Watergate period, how abuses of power can happen, and to try and find my own center, to constantly listen, to constantly be open-minded, but try to balance those two competing ideas. And then an enormous amount of pressure can be brought to bear for you to approve something. I was sitting in a position where my signature was required for some things to happen. And I remember making some decisions about what my view was on those particular decisions. And the pressure that was brought to bear on me to change my position was extraordinary. And until the point that the president decides, or in my case, the Secretary of State decides, I realized that I had a choice. For my career, if I wanted to make nice to a lot of people, I could bend my views and go with the flow and just sort of grit my teeth and squint my eyes and say, okay, this is awful, but I'm going to go ahead with it because everybody wants to do it, and it'll cost me if I stand up and say no. But I came out of it with an enormous sense of self-confidence because I was able to hold my own. I like to think, with the majority of the time, with grace, even in the face of considerable fury. And then, ideally, what happens when the president decides and it doesn't go your way, and it's happened both in my case. It's gone my way and it hasn't gone my way. In both cases, you hope that the leadership structure will turn to you and say, thank you. Either way, it turns out. It doesn't always come back and say thank you. Mm-hmm. And whether you can do it the second time is equally important as to whether you can do it the first time. So integrity, a sense of who you are, who you're working for, and you know what's important is very important. That's why I really hope that good people go into the intelligence business. It really needs good people.
Before, when you were talking about the struggle between our institutions, you talked about a moving balance with regard to what was acceptable for the country to do. Is there a moving balance in an individual? In other words, do you think, I'm sure you would retain your integrity if you were serving now in government after 9/11, but do you think that there has been a shift in the situation which wouldn't compromise your integrity, but would have you leaning more towards security than you were in the previous era?
Absolutely. I think that's an important part of integrity. It's not just it because you always thought this way in the past, you're going to continue to believe that and take the same position on into the future just so that you can remain consistent. That's a false integrity. I believe integrity needs to be about living in the present instance and restriking that balance every day, even if it means saying, you know, I was wrong a year ago. Now I'm looking at it, or I was right a year ago, but things have changed now, so I'm going to take an entirely new position. Don't force me to be consistent, because for me to be smart, I need to be constantly learning. The lessons learned process is very important, not only for governmental institutions, but for the individuals that work in those institutions. They need to constantly be evaluating how they did in the last go-around and come back and say, well, you know, I could have done that better. Or I did really well then, but things have changed. and I'm more convinced, more facts have rolled in, and that makes Joe's position over there a better position than the one I had at the last meeting. That's people who are able to do that. Sometimes it's hard to find them in government because it is, you make your reputation out of positions that you stake out at certain times. But the really good people, the really good people are the ones that can do that. That's why I thoroughly hope as we move into this next period, you know, we're going to be having intelligence hearings on 9/11 and was there a failure or not. There's a great debate over whether the timing of this is right since we're still at war against the terrorists and whether or not it should be a very deep study of what went wrong. I certainly hope that it's a thorough and careful look, not just, by the way, at the intelligence community or the DCI, but at the entire process, as it, including the appropriations process, the budget process, how resource decisions are made. Because I think lessons learned for individuals as well as for institutions is very, very important.
An important phase of your career was earlier, before you served in the Clinton administration, when you worked for Senator Danford and worked with the Senate Intelligence Committee. How did that congressional experience affect you and your understanding of embedding foreign policy in democratic structures like the legislature?
Well, I spent, 4 years on the Hill. And as I mentioned earlier, it just confirmed for me a profound respect for our institutions. One of the things it did for me was, because I was, I was a political appointee in the Clinton administration, and Jack Danforth is a Republican senator. Mm-hmm. And I was a Republican staffer when I was on the Hill. And I grew up in a family that was very democratic, as I mentioned earlier. I was very comfortable working for Jack Danforth because, you know, he never once asked me what my political views were when he hired me. He said, I'm just looking for smart people, because I want the best advice possible. There are some senators like that. There are other senators and staff that are very politicized. But I learned a lot about, as they say, how sausage is made. What goes into making our laws? And I was both astonished and pleased at the complexity and the rigor, and my respect for the institution grew. But I also was shocked by how appropriations sometimes happen, the log rolling. Well, if you fund my project, I'll fund somebody else's project. And I sincerely hoped that that didn't happen too much in the intelligence business, because you don't want politics infecting the intelligence process too much. In fact, it didn't. I was pleased to see that politics really, it was a very, the staff director at the time was George Tenet, who is now DCI, and he ran a very careful ship. It wasn't that politics was absent from the process of intelligence oversight, but it was rather that politics was recognized and then everybody was asked to rise above it. And I think that's what you're still seeing with George Tenet. And he's managed to survive from the Clinton administration and the Bush administration partly as a result. I think that the process of appropriating money on the Hill and authorizing funds on the Hill needs to be revamped for the modern age. I think that Congress could do better at how it funds the executive branch. And I think the executive branch could do better at treating Congress as a partner in foreign policy and national security policy. The intelligence community and the Defense Department actually are way out ahead of the other executive branch agencies in the fluency with which they have dialogues with Congress. The State Department, one of the, you know, it's dug its own hole to a certain extent. It isn't so good at congressional relations. I'd like to see many more people who have had experience on the Hill come into the executive branch and vice versa, so that there is a less of a confrontation between the branches and more of a working partnership like the post-World War II period that we had in matters of national security policy. It's harder in domestic politics, but certainly when we're in the national security arena, there's a lot to be said for politics stopping at the water's edge.
As we find this moving balance, the term you used before, it would seem that as we find ourselves in a new situation, that really leadership and political education becomes really a vital element in reconciling our past with where we are and where we have to go in the future.
That's true. And I think that the skills of leadership, before I left government, actually before Bush was even elected, I got a briefing sheet that had been prepared by the current Secretary Colin Powell. And he, as you know, was working in the private sector on, I think he was on the board of AOL and a number of other endeavors. In any case, he came up with a briefing on what makes for sound leadership. And I made copies of it and distributed it to all my staff because I thought it was so very important. It isn't just that you personally get it right and that you personally hit that moving balance. It's how you help other people come along and reward them for their struggle to hit that balance too. And that goes for whether you're Secretary of State and you're looking down into the trenches, how do you inspire your people to bring you bad news, to bring you the information you need to make the tough decisions, the last thing a true leader wants is for people to have figured out what he or she wants to hear and then just bring them that. A good leader wants a multifaceted input, and it's hard. That is the mentoring that needs to go on in government among managers.
One final question requiring a brief answer. How should students prepare for the future, if they're interested in the kind of work you have done?
Learn to write. Learn to write concisely, convincingly, and coherently. It's extremely important. I've had a very good career, and it was based in large part on getting noticed for the memos that I wrote. Also, learn to speak effectively, and see if you can experiment with finding that center to really establish what you think about issues and develop your integrity.
Jennifer, on that note, thank you very much for being with us today and talking about both your life and your interest and understanding of the world of intelligence. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.